3rd, 2011, and this is an interview with Mr. Harvey, Major Harvey Bayless, in Overland Park, Kansas, in his home. Thank you very much, Mr. Bayless, for your willingness to participate in this interview, and we'll begin with some very general questions here. Carol Burns is also our program assistant. She's also here. Okay, before you joined the military during World War II, where were you living and what were you doing?
I was drafted in the military in May of 1943. At that time, I was working as a radar mechanic in Boston, Massachusetts. We had a single African-American team servicing the SCR-270 radar, which picked up the Japanese over in Pearl Harbor, but nobody paid any attention to it. And I got drafted from there. And I went into military service.
How did you happen to get to Boston and in that capacity that you were working?
Well, when I got out of high school at 16, I went to a technical institute at Wilberforce studying radio technology. And it was a two-year course, but I only stayed there a little over a year, because once I got 18, I had enough 6 months experience in radio technology. I joined the Army Signal Corps as a radio mechanic. And because I had some formal training in radio technology, they sent me to a radar school. And at that time, we only had one African-American team. We had two engineers and three technicians. And I worked and went to school there at Lexus Signal Depot.
So where were you born?
I was born in Frankfort, Ohio. But Frankfort, Ohio is a small community, about 900 people. Mm-hmm. It's 12 miles north of Chillicothe, Ohio, which was the first capital of Ohio, or about 40 miles southwest of Columbus, little town. I was born and brought up there. I went to school, high school there.
When the war broke out after Pearl Harbor, what was the general view in your community? How did they view the war?
I can't really discuss that because I was in a technical school. At that time, I presume everybody was willing to serve, find some way to be a benefit or to be a service to the nation.
How did you view the outbreak of the war?
That's a loaded question. I had a job, and I'd gone through this, but again, my job was predicated on the fact I had taken formal training in radio technology and also had gone to this radar school to become a radar mechanic to service radar equipment along the coast of the United States. So it was a job. I would have been contented at that time to just stay on that job.
So did you have any other views toward the war itself? Or?
No, you didn't. You knew that down the road that they would be calling on individuals to help. Now, if I had been a Caucasian, our work was so important that practically everybody, civilians, were given exemptions to service this equipment. But again, if I went into service as a military, it was not an integrated military, so when I got drafted, they said, we're going to send you to a group that's being formed to service communications equipment for the Black Fighter Group. And I joined them up in Oscoda, Michigan in June of 1943.
What was race relations like in the community you grew up or the place where you were in Boston at that time?
Well, that's a good question. Race, in a little town in Ohio, it's where you are. It's Southern Ohio is more prejudiced than Northern Ohio. But again, my father, he ran a lumber yard. He supervised a group of whites in the lumber yard. and he was part of the business community. See, but again, that didn't mean that I never joined the Boy Scouts, because the Boy Scouts was tied in with the churches, and we went to an African American Episcopal church. We didn't go to the white churches, but we went to an integrated school. And when I went to Lexington Signal Depot to go to radar school, I ran into one little problem there. We had to go a distance of 12 mile from where I lived in Lexington to the air depot. And in Lexington, the city buses were integrated, but if you took a Greyhound bus outside the city, it was segregated. And I never forget, one day there wasn't a seat, and I sat beside a Southern person from Mississippi, and he told the bus driver, this can't happen. So they brought the police in and they beat me up. But again, the idea was there, this fellow is probably a troublemaker, so they'll say, we'll take care of the damage to your body. We just want to get you out of the area. You don't fit. But again, that was a job at that time. There was no other place I could go. So I agreed to accept what they call damages to my body and stay in Lexington, because that was the only school there was. I had to be realistic. And we had an African-American crew, but once we finished our training, they finally decided to send us to Boston. And when we went to Boston, they integrated. They just said, we don't have an all-black, two engineers, three technicians. We're just going to put you out and with the teams that were there, white teams. And I felt comfortable.
So go back to this. Why did they attack you?
Well, the situation was, in going interstate, blacks were supposed to fill the bus from the back forward. There wasn't any seats. So when I got on the bus, the only seat was the middle of the bus adjacent to this white Southerner. And I sat down. I'm paying for a seat. I'm not trying to change the concept in the area. When you go into an area like this, I'm not a trailblazer. I'm just, even though I'm a survivalist, I want to be treated as any individual.
So when they attacked you, then what did they do?
Well,
did they take you off the bus?
Yeah, well, nothing but taking me off the bus. They carried me off the bus. I had been... you know, blood was flowing from my face and from my body. In fact,
Who attacked you?
Police. Their statement was that I was attacking them with a billy club. Here I am, and he's hitting me with a billy club, and my head is ricocheting from the base of the bus.
Were you in uniform?
No, I was civilian.
You were civilian.
And this is before you were drafted?
Yes. But again, thanks. We had Judge, you've heard of Judge Hasty? William Hasty?
Yes, yes, yes.
All right. The individual in our team, one of the engineers was from Philadelphia, and he knew Judge Hasty. So he contacted Judge Hasty, and at that time, before he decided to leave the Department of Defense, he was pointing out that we've got to enforce, the military leaders have got to step in and force equal rights when it was stated. So they went out of their way to first try to get me out of the community, and second to say, okay, we'll take care of the damage. And I never did really.
When they say take care of the damage, what does that mean?
Well, I was in the hospital for a day or two.
So they paid for your medical care?
Sure, yes.
Okay. So were there any positive dimensions to race relations, where you were or where?
Well, I there's always positive.
Right.
If you look for it.
Right.
And I met a fellow named Harvey Wally, a Caucasian, from upstate New York. I didn't know that I was going to be in upstate New York, but we got to be quite friends. But I really find that when you're in a Southern community, the relationships normally don't exist. You see this when you go into a place and you want to try on a hat or get a pair of shoes or your services or such, or even go to the library. In Lexington, if you wanted to get a book, you had to go to the black section and order the book, and they'd ship it to you. But you couldn't go in and browse.
Where did you live while you were in Lexington?
I lived on the street in the black area. I was about a couple blocks, not a couple doors down from Phyllis Wheatley YWC, and I had 8 meals there. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm just trying to coexist. And that time I was only 18 years old. Now, I felt like I was quite mature for 18 years old from the standpoint of being involved in affairs. You know, you go into community. The first thing I did when I went to Lexington, I talked to the porter and I said, where is a good place for a person to get a room? I knew he would probably know the black community. But then we'll tell you another story. When I got drafted, they shipped us from, we went to Rome Air Depot in Rome, New York, and they sent us by mistake to a white signal company in Columbia, South Carolina. All right, when we got down to Columbia, we said, Bayless and Neil, another gentleman with me, reporting for duty, and they says, well, this will be there in 15 or 20 minutes. Well, then nobody showed up in 15 or 20 minutes. And I called again about an hour and a half later, and they said, we were there, we didn't see you. They said, would you stand in front of the post office box outside? So we did. And when they came back, they thought they were going to be picking up 2 white soldiers. There's 2 blacks. So they said, oh, we made a mistake. So they said, stay where you are, and they went back. They had a troop carrier. They went back and got a troop carrier that had a canvas over it covered. So they... And they took us out to the signal company.
Because they didn't want you to be seen.
They didn't want to be seen. But when he got there, the commander, he was from Columbus, Ohio, he says, he gave us an exam. You guys are real talented. We'll try to get you into this. There's a black signal company being formed. And he says, all you have to do is take your basic training here. And they assigned us to a black, chemical warfare group. And we took our basic training. And then when we were in training, we would visit the 2 black women, female, you know, what was it? What's the name? Allen, and there's another black school there in Columbia. There's 2 black female schools, and we enjoyed it.
Yeah.
We took our 6 weeks training, and then they shipped us from there up to Oscoda, Michigan, where we joined the 1000 Signal.
So when you...
That's all part of my story here.
Okay. Well, let's kind of get into some of this. What was it when you were drafted? Where did you respond to your draft notice? You remember?
Sure. Fort Knox. No, wait a minute. Isn't that awful?
That's okay. Put you on the spot.
No, I'll just have to read the...
Well, that's okay. We can just get that from your essay.
Where's my essay?
Here, this one.
All right, but isn't that awful? Yeah.
And while you're looking for that, what was it like when you first put on your uniform?
Oh, I got a story on that one.
All right, let's hear that story. But that's okay.
Okay, we went to a... it was right outside of outside of Cincinnati. Well,
what was it like when you put that uniform on?
Well, let me give you an example. I was making about $3,000 a year back in 1943, which was a lot of money.
Good money.
So when I found out I was going to go into service, I went to my tailor and had a gabardine, dressed gabardines for a enlisted man. So the first day I reported for duty, they said, this fellow is out of uniform. And they took my uniform and put epaulets on it, and one of the officers was wearing it the next day.
But it was your uniform.
Well, it was.
It's too nice for you.
Well, they said you got to have whatever they give you issue, clothing.
But so that no longer belonged to you.
Well, I was supposed to turn in everything I had and put on the military uniform.
But was the officer white or black that was wearing it?
White officer at that time, because we were at Fort Knoxville. I got a mental block.
No, that's all right. That's all right. When you were going through your first training, what was it like? What did you remember? What it was like? How did you feel about it?
Well, I feel that you know, I've been away from home for over a couple, almost year and a half, mm-hmm. at 18. So I'd become very independent. So really, in a sense, and I've been working with military organizations in this radar. So I felt comfortable. I felt that any system they had, I'd either be able to beat it or be able to be smart enough. And on some of the exams, the reason I got the field commission is I had one of the highest. They would give everybody these exams to determine how smart you are. And I loved exams, so I always scored very high.
And that's how come you got assigned to what, were you saying?
Well, it wasn't. They were going to assign me as an African-American to this Black Signal Company. Mm-hmm. We had black officers, and it was 97 enlisted men and three officers.
When you were going through your training camp, who were some of your other friends and who were your friends?
Didn't have any friends.
Did you meet some new people that were...
Not that I remember.
Okay.
You know, what I'm saying, if they weren't going to help me, or if they weren't... You know, I was just there to take the basic training, so I didn't fraternize a lot.
Okay. What sort of things did you like or dislike about your training?
Oh, well, it was just... All this basic training is the same. You have to... learn to march. You have to learn to shoot. I never shot a rifle. My father and then we went out for hunting. But when you leave home at 16, you're not very mature from the standpoint of involvements. But I learned quickly. You know, I've become a sharpshooter on the range.
Did you like it?
I didn't like it. I never did. I figure that. I never did a lot of hunting. When I did hunting, I was hunting, used a bow and arrow. How many people use bow and arrows to hunt?
I don't know.
Very few. You know. I want to give the animal, give them a opportunity to, you know, get to escape. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but if you're good at the bow thing, you're not escaping. Okay.
Well, that's true. Could be. So we ended up in North Dakota, Michigan. At that time, the 96th Service Group and the 332nd, the 332nd had been moved out of Tuskegee Army Flying School. And they went to Detroit. And they stayed in Detroit for about a month or two at Selfridge Field. Then they moved up to Oscoda for gunnery training. Now, Oscoda was one of the few places that would accept this. Oscoda Mission... Michigan and the Oscoda Army Air Base we went for gunnery training and just prepare for to go overseas, but it was a rural community, and they had a lot of these super active African Americans. They would bus girls out of Detroit 200 mile on weekends for parties, so you know they didn't have a chance to take advantage of the local girls in the community, Caucasian, because it's a small.
Because it was not, they didn't want you to.
That's right. Well, they made it available so that everybody wants the bus and the girls. I didn't know.
That was thoughtful.
Yeah, Detroit was loaded. Well, so it fit the bill.
And, okay, so how did you get involved with the Tuskegee Airmen?
Well, you see, as I said again, down in Tuskegee, when they set up the 332nd Fighter Group, they also established the 96th Service Group. The Air Force says we do not want white enlisted men servicing the planes. So with four fighter squadrons and a group, they decide to set up a service group, which at that time the service group consists of two service squadrons to do 100R overhaul, major service of the aircraft. And they had a communications group, which is a mine, and they have a quartermaster group and a trucking group, and then an ordnance group. All this was to provide support to the 332nd Fighter Group.
So from
we all went overseas together.
So did you ever go to Tuskegee itself?
Never been there in my life, and now I know that they have a museum there.
Right, National Park.
Yeah, I had an opportunity. I just didn't go.
So you never went to Alabama?
Never. No, don't say I never. As a civilian engineer, I put in a lot of AC&W facilities. And when I would go to Alabama, because at that time I had a very important job, they considered me white. So they let me go into Admiral Sims and other hotels that blacks normally wouldn't be able to go into.
This was after World War II.
Yes, because they realized that I was essential to them getting the project against some other locality.
So we're back in Detroit, right?
Well, no. We were back in Michigan.
Back in Michigan. And so when did you discover you were going to go overseas?
All right. We were notified around the 15th of October, around the middle of October, that we would be going overseas. At that time, the problem was the Air Force was having trouble trying to place this group. At one time, they were going to take the 332nd Fighter Group and move it to Brazil. And Brazil says, we really don't need blanks there. We got enough. And then they were going to move it into Africa. And I hate to say this, but some of the African states, even states like Liberia, said, we got enough. So nobody was anxious. So we ended up going to Africa with the 99th Fighter Squadron. And then after that, it was the group came along later, and it joined the 99th when they had moved into Italy.
So you did embark for overseas, though.
We left from Cap Patrick Henry on January the 3rd, 1944. And we went on this Liberty ship. Took us 33 days.
What was that ship like?
Oh, Liberty ships. A Liberty ship would be about 7,500 ton, and it would have, it could accommodate maybe 800 to 1,000 troops. And you just packed, it would be, it was loaded.
So did you have separate sleeping quarters?
No, what do you mean separate sleeping quarters? I was enlisted, man. You had bunks.
Mm-hmm.
And you started on the floor, and there was about five bunks up to the top of the ceiling, and then there's bunks on either side. Now, officers were able to have some quarters. They would, even on that ship, they would probably put eight officers into a room.
Did you get seasick or anything?
I didn't normally get seasick. A good example. When we went on the ship, and this is something personal, I found one individual says, you get purchased decks of cards. At the PX there, I purchased about a half a dozen decks of cards.
Mm-hmm.
And I got on the ship. I love to play. I love to gamble. So I started running a gambling show. With nothing to do. And I ended up with maybe $3,000 or $4,000 with two bodyguards. You know, and because the only thing we did, It was stories like this, and that in the morning we'd eat around 8:30, and then we'd eat again around 4:30. Well, the food was bad, and there wasn't that much of it, so I'd wake up, I'd hire somebody to stand in line for me. And then when I woke up around 5:30, 6 o'clock, I took his place in line, and then I was always in line first. And then the moment I finished going through line, I'd get my books out and wash my mess kit and get ready for the evening meal. Wasn't nothing to do. Stood there in line. Finally got so bad that the chaplain and the mess sergeant saying, that's such a bad example. So they said, we're going to have the line, the back of the line's going to go in first to eat today. And lo and behold, the chaplain convinced me to get to the back of the line. So they looked, and suddenly I'm coming in from the back of the line. They can't win. It makes an interesting story. You know, even though I was on the ship, you only had a little musette bag, and you had to wear your same clothes. Well, my clothes got so full of oil and dirt. My commanding officer says, Bayless, you got to wash your clothes. Well, I came up with the bright idea that I just throw my pants over with a rope and let the ocean warm. Well, what happened? The fish came up and ate part of my leg. So when I pulled my pants up, the legs were gone. Part of it. So I had to make shorts out of them, and I was out of uniform. But
did you get penalized for it?
Well, they needed me. At that time, I was a technician, third grade, and then a thousand signal. I was the top signal. I was top service, communication service rep. You know, I had gotten promoted from a private up to a T3. And that was there was a T3 for operations, T3 for maintenance.
So how long did you stay on that boat?
33 days. And on the boat, I got this in my story here, the Germans decided that the engine went down. Oh. And just about a day or so out of Gibraltar, and the commander of the convoy said, I'll leave you a destroyer escort for 4 or 5 hours while you're getting the ship. See if you can get the ship engine running. And otherwise, I'm going to leave you to your mercy, because that time the Germans would look for stragglers. Because many of them were there in Spain. And they would attack the convoys. Or either by using airplane or by submarine. Well, we were able to get the ship engine started. And that funny thing, everybody started to pray. I never seen so many Christians in my life.
So then what happened after?
Well, we landed in Toronto, Italy, southern Italy, and then we went to a place called Monte Cavino. Now, when I landed in Toronto, for the first time in my life, I had never seen a blood red orange. You know, orange, you ever... And, you know, and they had pecan trees and so on, and they had good old Italian wine. But the only thing I didn't like was, I can't take even today, what is it? Isn't that all? Well, I'm hitting some blanks today. You cook with it.
Oil. Olive oil?
No, it's a, you know.
Is it an oil? No, it's a garlic.
Garlic. I can't take garlic. Mm-hmm. I told my wife this is why I stayed away from my Italian girls.
Because of the garlic. All righty. So what was Italy like when you got there?
Well, the British had sunk a lot of the German. I mean, the Italian fleet there at Toronto. That was one of their major bases. And we just went to, when we ended up on the Tyrrhenian side of Italy, a place called Monte Cavino, and we were stationed at an airfield, Monte Cavino Airfield, which they had taken from the Germans. We invaded Italy in September of 1943, and this was one of their major airfields, and they gave it up. There was a lot of old German planes that had been destroyed on the ground. And we were in an old Italian castle, and we serviced our equipment there. And we would leave there and go to Naples. And we had part of the 332nd at Monte Cavino, and the other was at Campidoccino, which is a field right outside of Naples. And I always remember Naples because it was the worst city in the world. You could smell it about 10 or 12 miles out. It was, you know, just filthy. You know, they didn't take care. During the war, it was, mm-hmm. But.
How were the people?
The Italian people were nice. They were nice. They they realized that Americans were occupiers like the Germans, mm-hmm. and they wanted to exist.
Did you ever go to restaurants there? Or?
What restaurant? What do you mean by that? In the big cities, we would get leave and go to. I went to Rome, the Eternal City, one time on a 3 or 4 day pass, and I never smoked, so I would take my cigarettes, and when I was in Monte Cavino, I would take them into a smaller city called Salerno. And I'd sell them on the white market. Not the black market, the white market. Because I'm the black, I'm selling them on the white market.
All righty, that's very clever, very clever. So, not to get into trivia here.
We'll see.
Did you continue with your winnings from your gambling, or did you?
I got easy. I finally got to the point, I got so good, that I found people who were better than I was. And I started becoming a conduit. I would, everything I'd won on the ship, I lost in about a day or two after I got on. There was people who were better gamblers than me.
No, okay.
No, I'm serious.
Okay, all right.
So that's the main, I don't gamble at all now, even though we go to Las Vegas a lot.
Mm-hmm. You gave that one up. So, anything else about Italy that you remember?
Well, we went to, see the ruins of Pompeii. That was always very interesting. At that time, they had done some major excavation, and it was very interesting to see how the Mount Vesuvius. In fact, while we were there in March the 20th, Mount Vesuvius erupted, and we lost some of our planes to the fine particles in the air. And even though we had liquid cool engines, they damaged their engines.
Wow. So what kind of work did you have to do while you were in?
Well, basically, we just serviced with all the Air Force planes like P-30s, P-51s. Where am I here? All of these, one thing in common with the exception of the bomber. We only had an SCR 522 transceiver, which was good for about 50 mile. But we had to take care of the control tower, so we had the ground-based equipment, which is more powerful. But the average SCR 522 was only good for about 50 mile line of sight. So when we went on a 500 or 600 mile mission, the aircraft, our fighter aircraft, the only way they could communicate back to the base was to communicate with the bombers who had long-range radio, and then they could communicate with us. Once you left a 50-mile area, you were out of communications.
So where were the Tuskegee Airmen themselves?
They were at the field. We would have, we were with the 12th Air Force. We had the 99th Squadron had gone over, and it was at Camp Ticino, and the other three squadrons started out in Monte Cavino, but they ultimately two of them moved up to Campuchino, where the 99th Fighter Squadron. And then in May of 1900, well, we were flying the P-39s, mm-hmm. which was really a pretty sad aircraft.
Were only those aircraft assigned to the Tuskegee Airmen?
No, they were assigned to a lot of other groups. They, when they went over, they were assigned Coastal Patrol, and that was...
That's what the Tuskegee Airmen were doing.
Yes, yeah, Coastal Patrol. Mm-hmm. So we really didn't get a chance to...
What did they do in Coastal Patrol?
If a convoy was coming in, knowing that the Germans may try to attack it, mm-hmm. what you did, you had planes on the ground.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we're alerted that the Germans were going to try to attack this ship or this convoy, and then we would go out to try to intercept them.
So did you go on these missions?
No, they're a fighter group, only one pilot in the plane.
Mm-hmm.
We had to make arrangements for the communications, and that's about science. But there were other individuals. We had crew chiefs that got up early in the morning that made certain that the plane was fueled, and they had ammunition and all the other things required, parachutes and so on.
And so what was your main task?
My main task was service the radios.
Okay. Which was crucial.
Well, it was, yes, if you want to communicate.
Right.
And control tower, you know, mm-hmm. going back. We also had communication responsibility to our headquarters. And there we used ground-based transmitters, which are more powerful. So we had to report to the 15th Air Force.
So did you ever communicate directly with any of the Tuskegee Airmen during your work time, or you just did your own?
No. Why should... The average... When a Tuskegee Airman took off his plane, mm-hmm. there was only four channels in this. This is a four-channel unit. Mm-hmm. One channel was emergency. And one channel was in case you had get direction. He only had two channels. And he was supposed to be radio silence. Because the German ground communications would be able to determine if somebody is communicating. In fact, one of the problems when they first went over, I'm just speaking, is that they were talking so much that they were alerting the Germans they were coming. The black pilots. You know, you're supposed to have radio silence. Except when emergency.
Mm-hmm. So they were very silent. So after Italy, anything after Italy?
No, there wasn't anything after Italy. When the war was over,
stayed in Italy throughout.
We had no choice. You were in Italy until the war was over. And at that time, they were alerting us that we were being shipped to the Pacific. The only people that didn't get shipped would be individuals who were married with so many points. Being a single person, I was a prime candidate to go to the Pacific Theater.
So you were in Italy for what, 2-3 years?
I was in Italy from February of 44 until October 45.
So in terms of your being there, what did you enjoy most about your work there as a soldier?
We had a job to do, and I always tell everyone that we got the same food, we got the same equipment, and same support. The 15th Air Force treated all of the groups alike.
Mm-hmm. So you had the same everything?
Yes.
Now, did you ever fraternize with any of the white soldiers?
Not directly. When we would go to, for example, I got a field commission, so I had to go down to Barry and at that time, it was reluctance of the Air Force to commission blacks in the field. So we had four blacks that got commissioned, and there was only about a dozen individuals who applied to try to become an officer. And I was just 20 years old, and I had to put a good, positive spin, you know, by telling them that I was supervising about 30 people in communication and maintenance, and I knew my job, and we were keeping the airplanes flying. We were the wind beneath their wings.
So you became a commission?
I got a field commission. Only four blacks commissioned in all of the Air Force during World War II. That was one of the four.
Wow. So that was quite an honor.
Well, it was good. The way I look at it is that they would not allow enlisted men to have mattresses. And I had one of those little canvas cots. And, you know, even though I stopped gambling, I was still well off. But I couldn't buy it. You know, as a result, once I got to be a commissioned officer, I got quite a few more benefits. And another thing, too, they brought the Wings Over Jordan. This is my group. You've probably heard of Wings Over Jordan. Mm-hmm. Well, they came over and stayed at our group for about a couple weeks. And while I was there, I was escorting one of the young ladies, and I had a Jeep. She said, "You don't think I could really go for you, but you're a listed man." She said, "Our mom says, only associate with officers." Well, while she was there, I got my commission. And she saw that, and she said, "That's it."
So you started associating.
No, I said, "I'm going to be more selective now."
Oh. So, were there anything else about your experiences in Italy? Any controversy coming within the ranks? Any issues that came up that you...
No, there were other issues. For example, they indicate that one time, this is hearsay now, that one of the bomber landed at everybody had their own base. The bombers had a base. We had seven fighter groups in the 15th Air Force, and one was black. That was one last one that got there, the 15th. That was the 332nd. Well, the one of the bomber groups was forced landed at Ramatelli, and one of the crew members says, "I'm not going to sleep with those black people." And what he didn't realize is February and it's cold there. So they threw him a blanket and he got cold. So during the middle of the night, he said, "Well, maybe I will try it out once." So in essence, there was not a lot of... And the only thing you run into, for example, black enlisted and white enlisted would go to a rest center in Rome. We were all together. But black officers and the white officers were not... When they went to a rest center, they would send them to a different place. The whites went to the Ala Capri, and blacks went to some nondescript place there on the coast of Italy. But the Italians, they treated everybody, I would say. I think a lot of... you probably heard of this. Brooks used to be a first black senator. He married an Italian. He was in this 92nd Fighter Group. I mean, 92nd Infantry Division.
And did he meet his wife
there? He met his wife there. Yeah. So there was a few of the fellows, but we never really socialized a lot with them. We had a job 24 hours a day. You weren't in a position to fraternize. 7 days a week. Any individual, and especially I was in charge of the operation, I had to set them a good example. And I would have done it anyways. You know, I didn't chase the Italian women. I didn't drink the Italian wine. I didn't eat Italian food, if I could help it.
With the garlic? Okay.
So I was a perfect person.
So when you were near how did you leave Italy? Was that after the war?
Well, when the war was over... At that time, I got in my commission, so I came back as a commissioned officer. And there, they put four of us in a cabin together. And I came back and landed at Cap Patrick Henry again.
And so, were you discharged from there?
No. At that time, I didn't have enough points, so I left there, and they sent me to an air base in South Carolina.
What does that mean, you don't have enough points?
Well, even at that time, you had to have time and service. I got in 1943 in May, and you had to have, they count points in overseas. They give you more credit for that. But I didn't have enough points to be able to get out of service.
Did you want to get out?
Well, at that time, I didn't have any pros or cons. I had a civilian job they told me when I left my civilian job that they would try to find a job or equal when I came back. And I took them up on that, but I realized that's based upon the fact that it may not be there. And even that, when I got out of service in March of 1946, I applied for my job in Boston, and they said, "Well, now that's been taken over by Rome Depot in Rome, New York." So I went to Rome and said, "Can I get a job?" They said, "We'll only give you a job as a junior radio mechanic." At that time, I was a senior mechanic when I left, but you'll get the same pay. And so
same pay as a senior.
Well,
same pay as when you left.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. So. I didn't have any job, and I realized not when the war was over. The nation hadn't started to retrofit to a private industry, mm-hmm. And even when they did, there wasn't a lot of jobs for minorities. I've made up my mind early that I did not want to live in the South. I felt like if I lived in the South, I wouldn't last too long. Somewhere along the line, I'd run into something that would turn me off, and I'd go berserk or something. So Rome, New York was not like Boston, but it was a northern city, and I was treated very fairly there.
So
then I went back to work there, and then I went into the joint. I got in the GI Bill. I entered Syracuse University. I stayed there for about a year, and I ran out of money.
What were you studying while you were at Syracuse?
Engineering. So then after I got out of the after 1 year, I decided that even though they were giving me some income from the GI Bill, paying my books and so on, it wasn't adequate. So I went back to work at the air base. As at that time, I'd been promoted to a senior aircraft mechanic, and went to evening school. I went to evening school for about 3 years.
What were you saying?
At that time I had to switch my program, my major from engineering to physics. Engineering physics. At that time I was still a technician. So I got an engineering rating once.
Okay, and then, let's see, trucking group. And what was the fifth one?
Here we go, right here. Squadrons. 366 Air Service Squadron, 367 1000 Signal. 1050 First Quartermaster Trucking, 1901 First Quartermaster Trucking, 1902nd, 1760 Ordnance.
Okay, that's the one.
Ordnance. Okay.
Okay. And I was wondering, in your time in the military, in the service, did you ever have an opportunity to, make any improvements or innovations to the communications or the equipment?
Only on procedures. When I got in the 1000 Signal Company, you always heard the story that in the kingdom of the blind, a one-eyed man is king. So when I went in there, I found that even the officers, there no one was, because I'd when I was in Lexington in this radar school, it took 4 months to get out of the radar school because we found out we didn't have a diesel mechanic to go with us. So we had to go out and scrounge for an African-American diesel mechanic. So I stayed in the program and helped instruct and develop mock-ups and so on. So when I went into service, I knew every piece of equipment the Air Force had or the Army had, communications. Intimately, I was the instructor and so on. So I went up to 1000 Signal. The first job I got was some sergeant over communications, maintenance, told me that, he said, I want you to build a power supply using an 80 tube. Well, what happened, an 80 tube, the power supply required about 3 or 4 amps, and the 80 tube only had about 125 mils. So I went to commanding officer, he said, what's wrong with that? So they were all dumb, or not knowledgeable. So I ended up in about 3 months running the whole maintenance facility. And I found out the way I was able to do it. We had a lot of individuals come in, primarily in the South, that really had no training. But they could handle things by rote. I'd give them a piece of test equipment, like a meter for testing tubes. And I said, put a line there, and I says, push the tube in. If it hits that line, it's good. If it doesn't, you throw it away. Like somebody peeling apples or something that's either good or bad. And I tried to make use of the skill because I couldn't change people, couldn't get rid of them. So they're yours. You have to but find out what he can do that'll make us succeed. So I felt pretty good at that.
I should say so.
But the only trouble is I was always very egotistical. You know, I figured that I was smarter than anybody in maintenance. And they all knew that thing. And I hate to say it, that's just one of those things. You know, facts of life.
you're good at your job.
Sure.
Like you do.
Yeah. So I didn't have too much problem with commanding officers, the others, because they deferred to me. And I'm only now 20 years old. 19 when I was in the, started out. See.
How old were you when you left the military?
Well, I was only 21, going on 22. But a good classic example, we were up at Oscoda, Michigan. We went up there, and we had a high-powered transmitter, 400-watt transmitter that was communicating from Oscoda down to Selfridge Air Force Base. And the transmitter went out. And the commanding officer called our company commander and says, "You're a 1,000 signal? Go over there and fix that set." Well, the commander come along and says, "Does anybody know anything about high-powered transmitters?" And the only person in the organization was me. And I knew about those. I knew how to service them, so I went over. And the first day I got the transmitter, it wasn't neutralized properly. I got it neutralized, and I found out it didn't have a lightning arrestor attached to it. So I hooked up a lightning arrestor. 2 days later, we had a big storm, and lightning hit the station, and it knocked the operator out, and they had to send him to the hospital. And they had an inspection board, and they said, "Private Bayless." The Tom Thomas Gerald, a private. He took care, his fine work caused us to be able to maintain communications and keep going. And you see, what happened was that looked good for the commander.
Right.
Yeah, you know, at that time, I was really not only, I was walking on water.
Was that in Michigan, you say?
Yes.
Did anything like that ever occur while you were overseas in Italy or over in Africa?
Well, in Italy, I was not in Africa.
I thought you said you were.
No, in Italy, our primary job was to, a good example. The Air Force was using radar for the first time, airborne radar, where they were able. In those bombing missions over Germany, uh-huh. A lot of Germany, the climate is such that in winter months, you can't really see the ground. So you have to, if you don't have radar, they had these Norton bomb sites, but they couldn't see the ground. So they weren't able to conduct bombing raids. And when they got the radar, they were able to do this. Well, they didn't have enough radar. They only used a lead aircraft. In a bombing squadron, there's a lead bomber, and then there's maybe five or six bombers that when he drops his bombs, they drop theirs. So that was the bomber.
And they're behind him.
Yes, right. They dropped their. So as a result, what happened was the Germans started attacking these bombers, and because the bombers were located in southern Italy, even the go from where they were to before they went to the Alps was about 250 miles. And then they would go into Germany. Well, what happened was many of them would be shot at or damaged. So the United States decided we're going to put an emergency airfield in northern Italy right with the British. British were on the Adriatic side. And the American army was on the Tyrrhenian side. So we put an emergency airfield at a place called Falconara, which was about 200 miles north from where the planes were. And I was part of an emergency group. Well, they said, they went to the 1,000 signals, "Does anybody know radar?" Without regard to ground radar tied in airborne. But I knew the principles of radar. So they said, "We want you, when these planes are damaged, we got to take that radar equipment and take it down to southern Italy." So they would have a C-47 aircraft ready day and night, and we used to have to use mine detectors to go out because this was an emergency field. We were taking over from the Germans, and they mined all their fields. So, and we would take the radar out any time of day or night, plane would land, and take the radar down to southern Italy, and the planes at that time were equipped with racks and cable, but not the equipment. The plane would stay there for service. But the radar was taken out immediately because they needed it for the next flight. So they felt like that was a very important job. And of all the people prepared to know how to handle radar. I was the only person with 1,000 signal that had any radar experience.
Wow.
You know?
Very crucial.
Well, I fed.
Uh-huh. You and I have something else to
ask. I was going to ask you about, as a historian for the Heartland chapter.
Heart of America chapter.
Heart of America, I'm sorry.
Sure.
I looked on the web page and I was trying to figure out, when did you start as a historian there?
1996.
Okay, I didn't see that information.
No, they didn't have a historian.
Uh-huh.
They didn't have one.
So you volunteered for the mission?
Yeah, I didn't show you that, but I'm loaded. Every year I have a big yearbook I put out.
Okay. What do you mean by yearbook? We don't know.
Well, we put out, for example, I should bring one up from my basement files.
Uh-huh. I would love to see that basement file.
You just had a meeting over, what was it,
May something? Yeah, we had a, in April. No, May. We had the, we had this general, Vinson, I forget his name, isn't that awful?
That's okay.
Yeah. He was the commanding general of the over in Fort I'm off base today. Help me out. Over in Junction City.
Oh, Fort Riley?
Fort Riley.
Uh-huh. I saw that.
Yes.
In the paper. Yeah.
Yes. Vincent Brooke.
That's it.
Yeah. You know, I hate to say this, but my mind is, I sometimes I have to work on it.
Everybody does, trust me. Do you want
to ask some more questions? Oh, I was just curious, in your capacity as a historian, have you started a chapter on that, or a book, or like you have one of these?
Sure.
You've done that already?
Sure.
And is it available?
I'll show you a sample.
Also, I was looking on. I googled you.
Or you googled me. You saw a lot on Harvey Bayless and Google.
I did.
How about that? Yeah.
And I noticed that you. They have a. Is it just audio recordings of over at the Jackson County?
Historical.
Yeah, it's an independent.
Yeah.
No. What about that?
Or did they have collections of your photographs or your works or thing like that as well?
No, not to my knowledge.
Okay.
So I've spoken to the Historical Society.
Yeah, it looks like they had some recordings.
Yeah.
Of his speech?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me, when you were discharged from the military, what was that like? What was the discharge like?
They sent me to... isn't that awful? Again, I'm... They sent me to Indiana, to a military base, and I got discharged. That was it. You know, and they also said, we'll give you $20 a month, $20 a week for a year. It was $20 a month, yeah. And that was about the size of it. There wasn't any... you were on your own. They had not really completed the concept on the GI Bill. And the average African-American, I felt, I understood their situation because companies were getting ready to retool and rehire, but they hadn't hired that many blacks to start out with. You go into a plant, you find that there was a lot of white females, but not there any black females. They felt like they should stay home, take care of the white females' kids. But there was work was just not available, except for the post office and other jobs.
So when you got out, where did you search for work? I'm sorry.
I immediately went back to the people in Boston saying, I'm out of, I've completed my service. You indicated I was furloughed from my job. And they said, well, your job has been transferred to Rome. So I went back to Rome, and Rome that time had a major project where they were taking these B-29 bombers and retrofitting them for generals and everyone else. So I went back as a radio mechanic, aircraft mechanic.
Were there other African Americans along with you in that same capacity?
There was a friend of mine named Leon Mill. He was with me all the time I was in service. But when I went up there, there was really no other African Americans. There were African Americans at the base, but you see, during the war, the Air Force had to take blacks at the same proportion they took whites. So they had these airbase squadrons, and every airbase squadron was a group of blacks because they had a low stamen score, and they just picked up cigarette butts and did menial work around the base. So a lot of airbase squadrons, well, practically all of them, they got so bad that Judge Hastings and some of the others saying, look, they came up with some white airbase squadrons where they had low scores of whites. So in the Air Force, with exception of the Tuskegee Airmen, there wasn't any, and the 96th Service Group, that was the only technical groups in the whole Air Force.
So you were in Rome, and then from where did you go from there when you were in your work?
Well, all right, then the second part, I guess you know, Harry Truman integrated the armed forces July the 26th, 1948.
Okay.
And I had stayed in the reserves. So I joined, at that time I was working at Rome Air Development Center, I joined a reserve group there. And in 1951, I got recalled. That's what I'm working on now. Recalled and spent 2 years in Hawaii.
When you got recalled, what does that mean?
Well, basically, when the Chinese entered the Korean War in 1950, mm-hmm. the United States decided we got to mobilize. We don't have enough troops. So they called a lot of reserve groups back. A lot of the African Americans, Tuskegee Airmen, had been let go from service, and they recalled them back. Now, at that time, I was lucky. I was a Rome Air Development Center, and that Rome Air Development Center, I was the only black officer in about a couple hundred. But what happened, they decided they needed, because I was also a communications officer and a radar officer, they said, okay, we need these type of people over fighting there in Korea. So they transferred me. I was supposed to go to the 1808th Wing in Japan, but what happened was on my way, I stopped in Hawaii, and the radar wasn't working, and they signed me there while I was waiting to transfer to, mm-hmm. and I found out that the individual. The problem with the radar was that the automatic frequency control wasn't working properly. They had a CPS-1, CPS-5. And I go out and contact the people at Rome Air Development Center who designed that, and they sent me a kit to service it. So suddenly here's a one-eyed man, you know, 6/14 AC&W. You know, in fact, I didn't pick that to work for my son. But then that was in September of 1951. Well, by December, they decided that the AC&W group was running these radars just for air traffic control, planes coming in and out of Hawaii. And they decided to send this unit back to the States. And they said anybody been in the organization for 90 days would go back to the States, otherwise you go to Korea. Well, in the meanwhile, I went down to the Pacific headquarters, and I was only a first lieutenant. And they had a rule that you had to be at least a captain to be in headquarters. But they looked at some of my resume, and they said, this is our man. So Lieutenant Bayless joined the headquarters Pacific Division. As a communications staff officer.
And that was still in Hawaii.
Didn't want to leave. But I didn't want to leave from heaven.
How long were you there?
Until I got out in May of 1953. That was there for 2 years.
What was it like there in Hawaii?
Perfect, perfect.
Where did you live?
We lived in Kaneohe, which is a local community. And we joined the local church. We were United Methodists. And the minister next... In Hawaii, the missionaries, what they did, the Baptists took the immigrants from who came in from China, and another group took the immigrants that came in from Japan, because they need a lot of work in those pineapple fields and sugarcane. And the Methodists had another group, so we joined the Methodists, which had Holly, which Holly is white, and Japanese minister. And the Holly minister lived next door to us, so we got along real well.
When you say we, were you married to them?
Yeah, I was married. Yeah, I got married.
And when did you get married?
Got married December 3rd, 1945.
Were you still in the military then?
Yes, I hadn't got out of service. I didn't get out of service until March 46.
So how did you meet your wife?
Well, I told you. The way I met my wife was, I was at this radar school. You couldn't get into radar unless you had a secret clearance. Well, I had to wait for secret clearance like everyone else. It took me about a couple months. And they sent me down to a field radio school, which is right around the corner from where Mamie lived. She'd come by there every day with her mother. And the guy saying, you don't know, boy, that's a nice looking little girl there. He said, I bet you can't get a date with her. Well, he didn't realize I'd met her and I'd made a date to go see a movie. So I lived catty corner from her on Upper Street. I had rented a house, a room from a mortician and his wife, and it was nice. I was able to go down to on the corner. They had the YWCA, and Mamie was still in high school, so I was. You know, in fact, her parents all felt that even though I was only 18, she was 16, I was too old for her. You know, from the standpoint that I was mature, I was on my own and so on. So we started going together. And then when the war was over, she had went to Washington to work in the government as a clerk typist. And I proposed, and we got married.
So she was in Hawaii with you?
Yes, at that time we had a young child, a son called Roderick.
That's right. So how did you happen to leave Hawaii?
After 2 years, I didn't want to stay in. I had a choice. I could go back to my civilian job. And at that time, I ran into a problem that at Syracuse, I had about 58 hours towards a bachelor's degree. And they said, well, you can work up a range, but we'll give you an associate degree at 60 hours. If you want, and technology, and then continue on for your bachelor's degree because you're doing evening work, you know, in evening division. So I just went ahead and took it. So I got my associate degree in 1954, and I got my bachelor's degree in 56. All right, again, another thing. The government was saying, well, I was doing engineering work, but we don't consider you an engineer. But you can take an equivalence exam. They had a very thorough exam that, like you've heard of professional engineer's exam? Mm-hmm. And I passed that. At that time, I was the first person to pass the exam.
Wow.
So exam's always been a good point of mine. Mm-hmm. You know what I attribute that to? Mm-hmm. Speed reading. Speed reading.
Really? How'd you get into speed reading?
I got into speed reading early. I found out that at one time I was reading about 2,200 words a minute with 90% comprehension. And a lot of stuff you read, you have to be able to read it and understand it and make a decision on it. See, so many people take exams, the decision process is such that, you know...
It slows them down.
Slows them down, yeah. And most exams are set up for time. Mm-hmm. Hmm. So I've been pretty lucky.
So throughout the 50s and the 60s, where did you work after leaving Hawaii?
Well, then I worked with... When I came back from Hawaii, I was having some problems with the people at the center, the Rome Air Development Center. So they were setting up a new group called Rome Air Depot, and they were setting up a radar program. And as much as I had radar technology before I even got in, I took over a radar division, and I put in all the ground radars in the United States. Well, we had three programs, the M, M, and S, TM. And one was a mobile, semi-mobile, and the other was a fixed. So at that time, I ended up supervising about a dozen engineers putting radar all along the United States. I worked with the center here at Roots Gabar back in the 50s.
So how did you get to Kansas?
All right. In 1959, they decided that they were going to have an Air Force group called Air Force Engineering Installation Agency for communications. And I was one of the people that helped set the organization up in Rome. And then in 1970, they decided they wanted to combine with the group out of Scott Air Force Base that was doing operations at Riches Gabar. And they transferred me out here. At that time, I was GS-14, which wasn't bad.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
So
you remained here?
Well, what happened was, when they moved to Scott Air Force Base in 1978, I was 54. I waited till I got 55, and I left the government the moment I got 55. And I set up my own consulting business. And then I started working for companies like 3M and DuPont.
But that was all in this area.
Well, what happened was that most of those companies would have, we were doing some work here on development of new technology for fire suppression. And this company had gotten the contract with 3M, and I was the lead engineer, the test engineer. So I only worked about 5-6 months out of the year. I got good pay, and then I would go to Las Vegas and donate it to the cause.
That's good.
So I didn't stop working until I got to be 80. I stopped in 2004.
You maintained your consulting firm.
Well, yeah, we got to the point, my wife got macular degeneration, mm-hmm. and she had to give up her job of driving. So she said, I need a driver. You seen Driving Miss Daisy?
David, you've become that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Driving Miss Mamie.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That was good.
Yeah. Otherwise, I'd still be working.
But since that time that you've retired, have you been able to talk to school children? Or?
Well, I belong to a group called the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. And what they do, you want a little bit more of that drink?
I'll get me schooled.
Okay.
Thank you.
They go out to some of the schools and places. But you know the funny thing, it's a sad point. There's not a lot. The most blacks we have in our organization are from Africa. African. Natives,
right?
I've spoken to Central Missouri State. They have an aviation program, and I've worked with them on that program out there.
In terms of your, in terms of your personal life, how many children did you?
I have two children.
And did any of them go to KU?
Sure, my daughter Kathleen, graduate 83.
Why did you decide to go to KU?
It's a good school and it's cheap. In fact, at one time, they feel like there's no other school but Eastern schools.
Right.
If you're not part of the Ivy League or close to it, it doesn't count.
Right.
See, but KU was a good school. Of course, she had a lot of fun there. And I didn't expect her to be a Phi Beta Kappa, even though she graduated National Honor Society in high school.
That's great. And how do you feel about your participation in the war?
Well, I'm anti-war now, so the way I look at it is that the war has helped a lot of minorities. Have been able to get, it's just us, like this Brooks, General Brooks. His father was a general, his brother was a general. It gave them a vehicle to really, arrive at a place where they wouldn't have been able to. But the way I see it now is that the need for high technology, science and technology, is such that the average African American student, the instructors aren't too knowledgeable to start off with. And I just feel like that this is no, I don't see any easy way out. Yeah, of where blacks are going to be able to compete. Well, for example, in the West Coast, all the better colleges, a lot of Caucasians have trouble because the Asians get their top students. They spend all their time studying, and they're smart as a whip. So they're competitive. And you when you take scores, and a lot of all your schools, you have to have a score to get in. Our training, and in most blacks, to my knowledge, we work on trying to get them in aviation, but I've always looked upon aviation as a skill, more or less. You know, I'm not knocking pilots, because it's like you learn to drive a car or something. Once you go through the technique, it's rote.
So how do you view what you gained or what you did not gain from your military experience in World War II?
No, you learn discipline, and you learn to work as a team. All my life, I've been a staff officer, and I always felt good about that. I had to be pretty, in this 1842nd engineering group, we had about 300 engineers, and there was only one black engineer. And I always had a problem working with new bosses coming in and trying to fit in, you know. And we'd play golf together. We would, when we were in Rome, we'd go out to the, we had a horse track there. I'd sit, you know, I Harvey was a guy that fit in, you know. To the point where they felt like they needed me.
And you did that quite deliberately.
Yeah, well, deliberately, you got to face it. There's times that people I had trouble with, but by and large, I had to recognize my position and realize that you're dealing with the people that you want to bring out. You want them to bring out the best in themselves. You know, it's that's what I tried to do. Even now, my son calls me an Oreo, and my wife. And I don't. We go to a predominantly white church, and we've been going to this white church for 40 years now. We're one of the old members, and I talk with the minister, and I says, "Why aren't we having?" I've brought in some minorities, but they don't seem to fit. The first thing they say is the music isn't right, the preaching isn't right, and we don't feel comfortable. And I can't fight that, you know.
Yes, is there anything about your military experience or your experience during World War II, anything else you'd like to add?
No.
Well, we thank you very much for your time.
I was going to bring, you still want to look at the, can I show you that?
Yes, sir. We certainly are going to do that.
And while you're doing that, I'll bring up a copy, a sample of my historical
material. Thank you
material.
So much. Thank you for your time. We appreciate
okay.
it. Thank you.